Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Kieran Doherty. Without him, we just wouldn't sound as good as we'd like to think we do. And supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Carolyn Nikolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for a wonderful effort. And Bernie, all these new listeners, over the past couple of weeks, they just skyrocketed. A big Property Wizard thanks to our new listeners in Denver, Colorado, St. Paul, Minnesota, Seattle, Washington, Sugarland, Texas, Newark, New Jersey, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Forest City, North Carolina, Chicago, Illinois, Trois-Rivières, Quebec, Walled Lake, Michigan, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Orleans, Ontario, a little closer to home, Haywards Heath, West Sussex, Sydney, New South Wales, Melbourne, Victoria, San Francisco, California, Burnaby, British Columbia, Waynefleet, Ontario, Great Falls, Virginia, Fort Myers, Florida, and Laval, Quebec. Thank you all for joining us here at the Property Wizard. All right. So how about a recap from the previous podcast with Christine Wilson and Kurt Roman from Cambium Environmental? That was a repeat performance. What did you think of that, Bernie?
We had a really good conversation. And we kind of reinforced the reasoning why you do an environmental assessment. And also, if you've done one in the past, you can't assume that everything is still 100% because the regulations may have changed. You know, what is it? Amount of asbestos has been redefined. That's permissible, right? So that can change everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And different states and different provinces constantly update and change environmental standards that engineers need to abide by. And we had quite a lengthy conversation about particular parcels of property, which maybe 15 years ago passed with flying colors, but today would require remediation. So wonderful. Super. You've got mail. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
Yeah, Fred, we have Amid from Toronto. He's hoping you can help him out. He's considering buying a small commercial building, and the information he's been sent by the agent says a Class A building. One of his investment colleagues says it's no way a Class A building. Could you please tell him what makes a Class A building and what the difference is between one that is and the one that isn't?
Okay, wonderful. Welcome, Amid. I really appreciate your question. It's a question that I'm asked quite a bit, and I can understand where the confusion is. So this comes up again quite often. So let's see whether we can clarify it. Generally speaking, Class A buildings are the most attractive buildings, and they're located at the most prestigious of addresses within a city. Most are outfitted with high-speed elevators and have access to the latest amenities. And by amenities, I'm referencing health clubs, concierge services, and technology. As a result, these buildings command the highest per square foot rent. Class B buildings tend to be in less desirable locations and have fewer amenities. They generally command less in terms of rent. And finally, a Class C building is usually an older building located at a perimeter of an area's central business district. That isn't necessarily true in all instances, but for the most part, it holds true. Or they have little or no built-in technology, like, for instance, an elevator that tends to spit and stall at every floor, and maybe the doors don't quite open and close the way you wish they would. In some cases, the buildings themselves may be near functional obsolescence, which means there's very little that can be done to remediate the deficiencies. Now, I don't know where your building falls into those categories Amid, but this is very important. While what I've just said may seem pretty straightforward, where the confusion usually lies is that although these characteristics are indicative of building classes in a larger urban market, they are not necessarily characteristic of building classes in smaller urban areas. For instance, a Class B or even Class C building situated in a city like Toronto or Dallas might represent itself as being a Class A building in a smaller urban center. There are no hard and fast rules as to what category of building should fall into. Each market is unique, and which class a building may fall into is strictly a matter of what position that building holds and how it relates to other buildings within that unique market. So have I totally confused you? Do you follow that, Bernie?
Yeah, it's in context. It's, you know, where it is and relative to everything else that's around it.
Absolutely. That's right. So if you want to send us some more particulars, it's very, very easy, Amid, to turn around and find out exactly what class your building may fall into. But if you're in a major urban center, the competition is going to be pretty stiff as far as, you know, suggesting that a building that doesn't have most of the Class A amenities we spoke about, it would be pretty difficult to argue that, you know, if the building doesn't have those type of amenities, that it'd be a Class A building. So now that I've totally confused you, if you'd like a further in-depth analysis, then please just send us the address and we're happy to do that for you. Thank you, Amid.
John from Lake Placid, New York, has a question. Can you explain to him what building on spec means? And he also comments, by the way, great podcast.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. Always nice to hear from someone from Lake Placid. Love going down and visiting, although I haven't of late because of COVID, but I'm planning on returning. Simply put, building on spec, or in other words, building on speculation, means building a building, usually commercial in orientation, warehousing and retail primarily, for which you do not have a tenant already in place. It is not necessarily for the inexperienced investor or developer, primarily because banks and lending institutions are hesitant to lend money for development unless you have a proven track record in the industry or already have a tenant in place. In strong markets, where demand far exceeds supply, there can be little risk. However, be careful of the economic cycles within your geographic area. By the time you obtain the necessary permits and approvals and actually build the building, the demand may have waned. And for those of you that have taken the Intro to Real Estate Investing course, you'll have a better handle on what it is we're referencing. The real estate cycle always lags behind the economic cycle. And that's primarily because it takes time for developments to be approved, for buildings to be constructed. And because of that, you need to be very, very careful about where you fall as far as the timing is concerned. Thank you very much, John. Very much appreciate the question. Is there anything else?
We have Rebecca from Ashburn, Virginia. She's trying to find an investment club or group that she can join to find out more about investing in real estate in her area. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, thank you for your question, Rebecca. I would very simply suggest doing a Google search for investment clubs in Ashburn, Virginia. We've actually completed one for you, and we'll be sending you what we've been able to find to you shortly, if you haven't already received it by the time this podcast airs. For our listeners outside of Rebecca's area, there are plenty of ways to search for like-minded individuals. Scan the local community newspapers, message boards, speak to someone you may know who has already started a real estate portfolio of their own. And if you're coming up blank, consider starting your own. But there are just a few caveats I'd like to mention before we wrap up, though. Never send money to someone promoting an investment in real estate directly. Send it to your lawyer instead. Never go to meet someone you don't know alone. Always bring a friend. And don't share too much personal information about yourself with strangers. These are all common sense points that bear mentioning again. Again, thank you for your question, Rebecca.
Perfect. So if you have any questions for Fred, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And by the way, always remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Welcome back, listeners. So I'm going to preach to you today about something which is a constant underlying theme. The first thing I'd like to bring to your attention is the headline that was from the 2023 Swanepoel Trends Report. I'd like to read you the following. The single-family home investment landscape has changed quite a bit over the last decade. Not only has activity picked up markedly, but larger institutional investors have entered the market, including those specializing in short-term rentals and single-family homes. Let me repeat that, single-family homes built specifically to rent out. While still a small part of the landscape, their presence could begin to influence housing to a greater degree as their activity increases. So the point that I'm trying to make here, and we've talked about this, I can't stop and count the number of times, that when we talk about investment real estate, it does not have to be your typical duplex, triplex, 4-unit, 6, 10, 20-unit building, or your retail plaza. You can start a real estate investment portfolio by buying a single-family home, whether you live in it or not. Now, you know my feelings on this. As I've often said, because I'm asked quite often, what should I do? Should I buy myself a house or should I buy myself an income property? And what do I say, Bernie? You can do both. Buy yourself a home. Consider putting an in-law suite in the basement. Maybe rent out a room. If you're locked or the building permits, build an addition to it. And we're going to talk a little more about that a little later. The point that I'm trying to make here is that when major investment institutions start buying up complete developments and renting them out for the sole purpose of renting these residential units out, what do you think that means, Bernie? It means that they have turned around and they've said, you know what? There's going to be a real need for rental housing. There is a real demand on this. Because these, whether it's a REIT, whether it's an insurance company, development company, they are going in and buying complete developments, not just a single family home, but developments that consist of 50, 60, 100, 200 homes. And they're doing that because they think, and I happen to agree with them, that the rental market is going to completely reface investment real estate. It's no longer multiple units that hold sway over the overall investment market. You can invest in a single family home and accomplish the same thing that these big players are doing. So keep that in mind. Swanepoel goes on to say that although smaller investors dominate the landscape when it comes to buying single family homes, big investors are right now buying up inventory. So again, keep that in mind. What are they doing with the inventory? Well, there's a number of build-to-rents. Builders develop new home communities with a plan to rent out each of the single-family homes or have agreements with investors to purchase multiple homes as rental units. It's no longer multiple units as a rental property. It's multiple homes as rental units. Now, right now, that only represents about 6% of all single-family starts. But when the market's tight to begin with, when we're not generating or building enough homes that just the general populace needs or requires, when you've got the big players coming in and buying up these large development sites, it just tightens the rental market all that much more. So if you've been a listener for the past couple of years to the Property Wizard, you know I've been preaching this strategy. Well, guess what? The big boys are doing it now. So don't wait. Don't wait. Start. Because this is the type of trend that in 10 years' time, you're going to be looking back and saying, I really should have done that. I should have maybe bought a couple single family homes. Now, some of you are going to turn around and say, well, how am I supposed to make that work? Like, really, single family homes are pretty expensive. How do I make that work? How do I make it work financially? And again, if you've been a listener to this podcast, you know what the answer is. Add furniture. Yes, add furniture. So if you need to hear more about that, go back. And I don't know which podcast it was. Was it season one or two, Bernie, that we talked about adding rental furniture to your home? That was with Monique Doucette.
That's right. I think it was in season two, though.
Season two?
I think
yeah,
so.
I apologize, listeners. I don't know exactly what podcast that was, but listen to it. It's well, well worthwhile. I know I'm going on a bit today, but I want to further explore and talk about ADUs, accessory dwelling units. So I found an article written by Jeff Kruth. And again, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing your names correctly. And Murali Paranandis. In this article entitled, How Backyard Granny Flights Could Help Flights, How Backyard Granny Flats Could Help Solve the Housing Crisis, they write a very, very interesting paper and make a very good argument for something that we've known about, quite frankly, for a couple of years now, and we've been preaching about. But let me read what they've written in parts. Let me just paraphrase. Over the past century, the U.S. has lost a rich variety of living options because of zoning policies that prioritize single-family housing, as well as developers' desire to have inexpensive and easily replicated building plans. And we know that's the case, not just in the U.S., but across Canada as well. These development prescriptions are so pervasive that it's now illegal to build anything other than a single-family house on 75% of residential land in American cities. Single-family zoning restricts the supply of affordable housing, leading to higher costs, displacement, and segregation. So their solution to all this is enter the ADU or accessory dwelling unit. So many of you may have already heard of tiny homes, but they maintain that the ADU, accessory dwelling unit, was the original compact housing. So they list a few pros. Number one, ADUs provide more diverse living arrangements that are both desirable and necessary. Okay, all right. ADUs contribute to sustainability goals primarily because they encourage density. It's a very, very important point. They're also strong advocates of ADUs because they're smaller and they require fewer building materials to construct and less energy to heat. ADUs are also very nimble and adaptable. 20th century forms of development often took a scorched earth approach to redevelopment by tearing down entire communities, often communities of color, to build entirely new districts through urban renewal programs. Finally, they say ADUs do not disrupt local communities because they don't require buying up more land. They help add to the density, introducing new people from different walks of life as neighborhood populations grow. So they become very attractive to small business owners, coffee shops, restaurants, and grocery stores that are more likely to flourish with more residents in a given area. As with so many things in the U.S., California leads the way. To be sure, and I'm quoting the gentleman now, there's plenty of opposition to ADUs. It often appears from local residents who fear that there won't be enough parking spaces to accommodate new neighbors, and that adding more dwellings to their neighborhoods could decrease property values. I don't necessarily buy that argument, but it is an argument that sometimes is put forward. Now, Los Angeles has had a unique approach to encourage ADUs. The city recently launched its Accessory Dwelling Unit Standard Plan Program. Let me repeat that. Accessory Dwelling Unit Standard Plan Program, which offers homeowners and developments the option to select from 20 pre-approved ADU models for construction. And the plans range from a studio structure of less than 400 square feet to a 1,200 square foot house with three bedrooms. Since construction or conversion is still relatively expensive, and it is, as with so many other things, you know, it's going to cost you more per square foot to build a smaller structure than it will if you're building a much larger one. And because these are structures that are smaller in size, they can be prohibitively expensive. However, the state of California also offers homeowners a $40,000 subsidy to encourage the construction of ADUs to make them more affordable. Now, there's a useful incentive. I wish, you know, they would bring that up to Canada, well, at least in our jurisdiction anyways, because I think that's exactly addressing the issue. You're getting exactly what you pay for, and the money is going exactly towards solving the issues. Now, the authors go on to say that California's various initiatives have largely been successful. ADU permits increased from 9,000 in 2018 to over 12,000 in 2020. That's a pretty substantial increase. That provides a 33% increase over what it was in 2018. Now, apparently, because of this success, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Pittsburgh are all testing a similar ADU pilot project. So good for them. And that is all I've got for In the News. Today, I had the great pleasure of introducing a friend of mine, Michael Lewicki, LCCI, real estate broker with Terra Firma Real Estate and Solid Rock Realty here in Ontario. Mike has enjoyed working with the condominium world since he joined organized real estate over a decade ago in Ottawa, Ontario. He has an active real estate team that trades in both residential and commercial real estate. Mike is currently director at large and communications chair of the Eastern Ontario chapter of the Canadian Condominium Institute, or CCI. He is also a proud recipient of the LCCI designation, a designation from the CCI National given to those who meet the criteria to be called a leader of the Canadian Condominium Institute. When he's not excitingly reviewing status certificates for his bedtime reading, he enjoys spending time with his wife and daughter, seeking out the best local diners. A man after my own heart. Welcome to the show, Mike. It's great to have you on.
I'm excited to join you. This is going to be a fantastic topic, though I am slightly biased.
That's okay. That's exactly what we need. We need passion. We need passionate guests. And you definitely are passionate about this topic, and hence the invitation. We are tickled pink to have you today. So tell me, Mike, what are some of the pros when considering a condominium as an investment property?
It's actually the items that most people consider a con. Which, you know, as realtors, we obviously always have multiple opinions on multiple topics. But when people say to me that I don't like condominium living because it's restrictive, you know, there's legislation around it. I've got other neighbors around me. I've got all these things. I'm like, those are exactly the reasons you should be running towards condominium living. So firstly, let's address legislation. The legislation is provincial, as with most provinces in Canada and in the States, stateside. That legislation sets a framework for understanding for those living in communal living, right? It gives a framework to say you're going to live together. Let's set up a framework to understand that. Let's work together to create a set of rules and regulations that allow enjoyable living for everyone. Then people say, well, I got too many people close to me. Okay, I mean, like everyone, I would love to buy a Casaloma in Toronto. I think it's a great place. It's on the water. It's got fantastic dining rooms and a library to entertain all my 355 friends when the Queen comes to town.
Great restaurant.
Right. But I'm not paying electricity. I'm not going to use half the rooms. And in today's day and age, you need to have efficient living to have enjoyable living. And a condominium living, whether it be a townhouse complex, a low rise, a mid rise, or a tower, allows you to enjoy the benefits of homeowner living with having efficient allocation of resources, structure, and environment. Then people say, I want these 50-minute neighborhoods, which as realtors, God love when we do that. 50-minute neighborhoods. 15 minutes, that's a whole different topic for different podcasts. But when you look at condominium living, again, whatever type it is, it tends to put you closer to local amenities, the downtown core, closer to transit, which is the concept you want for living. You shouldn't have to spend your entire life driving everywhere to get a bag of milk. You either want to enjoy where you live or enjoy your community, which condominium living gives you. Condominium living. You've got condo directors. You have legislation on property management, which gives you control mechanisms, have checks and balances. So all of those cons to me are the pros to buy into condominium living, either as personal or investment.
Absolutely. All great points. I want to go back to the point that you made about it being provincially legislated.
Yes.
We're very much aware as realtors, like a condominium is really a creature of statute. When the concept of condominiums was first created, there wasn't really a way to convey ownership of a piece of the sky. Now it's going way, way back. Just for clarification, was that a federal statute or is it still a provincial statute?
Right. So it is provincial. The quick Reader's Digest version of that is The Act started to come into play in 1998. That's when the Condominium Act in Ontario started to come into play, right? Before that, it was a mix of some common law. You know, you had some case law, had some precedent setting that kind of went around, essentially shared ownership is what it was. And then the government said in 1998, they said, hey, there's a good idea. Maybe we should kind of put some rules around this living. So that's sort of the process and really the genesis of what we refer to as the Condo Act 1998. And since then, there have been a multitude of updates, changes, legislative, you know, alterations to that contract. An interesting piece of real estate trivia. The first high-rise condominium in Canada celebrated 50 years in 2019, and it was here in Ottawa, just off Meadowlands. And wow. It is one of the most beautiful condos I've seen. The square footage, the layout, true condo living, 50 years in 2019.
That's a great piece of knowledge. So the fact that it's provincial legislation would account for why in BC, these units are not referred to as condominiums, but strata units.
That's right. So they're called strata units and they have the Strata Act.
Okay. So are most of the codicils that are included in one piece of provincial legislation, do they have parallels and maybe legislation that's being created by another province?
Absolutely. So a great way to look at it is they are similar but different only when it comes to regulations within that province. So if we're looking at Ontario and BC is a very similar nature, right? We call it a condominium, they call it a strata. But when it comes to the rules, bylaws, and regulations, they tend to be very similar unless there's been some precedent, some, you know, government pressure for legislation to change the language. So for example, up until recently in BC, you could not rent out your strata. They changed that, put legislation, and said now anybody can treat it like a traditional rental property. Before it was controlled for owner ownership. So that changes the dynamic there, changes legislation. And then you've got Alberta, Saskatchewan, you've got Nova Scotia, you've got all the other provinces that have different legislation, but they're all very similar. And there's organizations like you'd mentioned on the bio called the Canadian Condominium Institute. They have a national, right? And then we have 17 chapters across Canada where we all get together to assist each other in understanding everything from insurance to building to mechanical to the envelope of the building. Everything's in there. And that's why you'll see similarities in legislation, right? And this goes back to a future conversation. Make sure the person who's helping you with any question with condominium actually knows condominiums because, and I say this lovingly to our industry, yes, it qualifies for a residential mortgage. It does not mean it's the same as a home.
Yes, very important point. And for a lot of the reasons that you just mentioned, they make great investments.
Absolutely.
Essentially, it's hands off. So, Bernie.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, the cons are actually the pros. So what are the cons then?
Well, the cons are, and this goes back to, is you need to want to be knowledgeable about owning a condominium because too many people treat them as a hands-off, meaning they don't have to be involved. What the hands-off portion means is you get to delegate a great portion of the capital expenditure, depending on the condominium, to professionals, and you're not in that mix every day, right? It's like, I have an accountant. I understand my taxes. I sure as God is not going to do my taxes, but I need to understand them. I'm hands-off in the production of the paperwork, but not in the involvement. So the negative is this. There's a lot of misinformation about condominiums, low fees when you buy a new build. They told me I can't put a plant on my balcony. They told me I can't smoke and my tenants are noisy. The biggest con with condominiums is the lack of knowledge. And I blame that solely on people who are in the condo world because you get so far down the rabbit hole, we know it, and we don't know how to properly articulate that to the member of the public. One of the biggest cons is people are afraid because they've heard the horror stories or they get involved and they really weren't prepared to own a condominium.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Really good point. All right, let's move on to something a little more administrative. Are there any specific documents that I should be requesting when considering a condominium as an investment property? And could you kind of expand on those for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So some key documents, we'll get into the purchase process in a second, what that triggers. The rules and regulations. So the rules and regulations, if we're going across Canada, right, we're going from sea to sea, they're enshrined in provincial law. And I say this, your board of directors are owners. Your property manager is an employee, but they have to act by law under the applicable Condominium Act. And those rules and regulations were drawn up by lawyers who specialize in condominium law, right? They specialize, essentially, they're creating a corporation, which those in business understand the nuances of that, right? Then you're going to throw in people, and then those people are going to create an environment for living. So those rules and regulations will tell you as to how that condominium living is to be managed. But it also tells you, as part of that process, you know, is there common elements? Because this goes back to expenses, right? You need to find out, is there going to be elevators, common amenities, which are benefit to your tenant, but an expense to you? So my wife knows this, but way back in the day, I used to be pool maintenance for municipality. So I will never buy a house with a pool. And the average person out there now who's a millennial or a Gen Xer says, I really, really want to buy a house with a pool. I grew up with a pool. I love a pool. And I go, no. Your parents owned the house with the pool. They maintained the pool. You used the pool. There's a big difference between using a pool and owning a pool. And it goes back to a condo. So you need to understand what you're buying into, because if it's a benefit, it's also a cost. And then people go, well, how do I know that if I'm buying a condominium? It's a massive infrastructure, a whole world of living. There's a document called a status certificate. Now, that's mostly most provinces. Out west, they're called estoppels, right? Because of the language around it, but it's the same thing. And status certificate is exactly what it says. It's the status of where the condo is right at that moment. The financial health, the scenarios are going through, any legal costs, anything. And it's a certificate stating they certify this information the moment it's prepared. And it goes from everything to who's sitting on your board, you know, what percentage of units are rented out. Is there financial considerations? Are they considering a special assessment? Is there pending legal issues? Which I'll be honest with you, I also sell businesses. God, I wish I had these kind of documents. Because again, it's prescribed by law what they must include.
Brilliant.
So the key document is your status certificate. And from there, you kind of rip details out of that and kind of figure that out.
There we go. Status certificate, listeners. Very important. So, Mike, if I have an issue with the condominium itself, whether it's a maintenance issue or a complaint about another owner, who do I register my complaint to?
Perfect. So if it's within the community living, and let's just say that I have an issue with my neighbor, and it could be noise, it could be smoke, and which interesting concept, in Ontario, because your balconies are considered to be exclusive use common element, they can actually ban people from smoking in their balconies.
So, which brings me to a point, can they ban you from smoking inside the unit?
Yes. And they're not required to grandfather you if you'd smoked in there for 20 years and it's been held up in court.
Really? Isn't that interesting? So,
communal living and the act supersedes the personal choice, which is why I love the act very much.
Wow.
To your point, so say I got a concern with my neighbor making noise. You need to go to the condominium board. Right. If there's a manager, you go to the manager who by default acts on behalf of the board as an agent of the board. Right. And in the Condominium Act, there's a prescribed process to deal with owner concerns. The owner's committee, right, or your directors are required to act like most directors in a prudent, efficient, and responsible manner. Right. They have to act in the best interest of the community and be seen to be doing things that are proper due diligence. If they don't, their director's liability may be in question. If they're doing it for personal gain, if they're friends with the concerned party, all that fun stuff, they must remove themselves from that concept, which is a hard thing for many people if they're not into board governance. And that's a big misunderstanding, right? Directors don't just meet once a month. You have requirements as a director. You have legal requirements. You have ethical requirements. So if you have a concern about a fellow owner or a maintenance in the building, you go to the board and or the property manager. Now, if you have a concern or a complaint regarding the property manager, you go to the board. Or if you're not sure if there's a concern with that whole environment, you go to the CMRAO, the Condominium Managers Authority of Ontario, and they're the regulatory body. You can submit a concern, a complaint through them.
Right? Wow. So there's lots of avenues or venues of recourse if need be. So that's actually quite comforting. Bernie.
So who can sit on the condo board? Like, who determines that? And, you know, if someone says, listen, I want to be that director, I have the ability to govern.
So the way it typically works, and we're going to use Ontario, I don't want to speak from either provincial partners, mostly because I know the lawyers in those provinces and I don't need a phone call on Monday morning. So in Ontario, the way it works is like most corporations, and this is the key thing is, right, the condo is a corporation, right? So there's parameters, there's ownership, all that fun stuff. And they set out the requirements for to be a director, right? So first thing is, you can't be in a whole financial concern or be in arrears for your funds, right? You can't not have paid your condo fees. They're run for director. And this is very similar in many other corporations. Like if the three of us want to be directors, I don't know, of Toyota, well, I can't be owing Toyota money and can believe that I can separate that concern and then vote for the best things for Toyota, right? So like if you think of the bigger picture, it makes sense, right? Now, depending on the corporation, it's preferred if you are an owner in there. But in theory, some of these you could be elected outside of that. There's been a bit of a push and almost a thought process that there'd be professional directors for condos. I get calls a lot. I love condos. I review AGM minutes. I'll talk to you about condo docs because I've made those decisions. I sit on a few associations myself. And a lot of times it's a lot to download on an individual. But typically speaking is mostly you'll find people who are an owner in the property, right? They'll run for election. The elections are typically held every year at the annual general meeting. And the government has, God love them for their efficient and fast thinking process. They finally decided, and yes, this is sarcasm, that maybe it's a good idea to pass legislation that allows for virtual meetings when they made a special exception during COVID. They thought maybe we'll make it law. So yay for the government for being proactive. I know I'll get chirped for that one, but I really don't care. Like it took them that long. So they'll either be a virtual or in-person for the AGM. You can be nominated beforehand. They send the notice for AGM minutes a minimum of 21 days before the AGM. So if there's a current board member who wishes to continue to stand for their position, who's up for election, they'll name themselves or they may not. You can nominate someone. You can also take proxy votes. Again, this goes down that rabbit hole. I'm happy to have a call about AGMs. That's a different exciting topic. Or you can be nominated from the floor or nominate yourself. The vote is done, I'm going to use a secret ballot. And again, that's protect the votes, right? It's not like, oh, there's a whole secret society going on. The secret vote, the private vote is to protect the person voting, knowing that they're voting in confidence. Now, people go, well, I've been at AGMs where there's a public vote. Yes. If you're going to pass a rule around smoking or the weight of the dogs, which you can pass a rule about the weight of the dogs, you can. Then you want to often have a public vote. Right. And there's things and mechanisms of an AGM. But for the directors, you can nominate yourself, be nominated. If you're a sitting director, run for re-election. I would recommend if you're going to run, which I always recommend, every owner should run at least for one term. Talk to the current directors and ex-directors.
Good point.
You need to find out. It's like going to apply for a job, right? Talk to the employees. So yep. Those are key, but pretty much you don't have to have experience. That's the first thing is you don't have to be a lawyer, an engineer, a real estate broker, or you know, an accountant. You as an owner have a lawful right to be involved in your community living. It's enshrined in law. You should be involved. And you're not going to become an expert until you get involved.
These are unpaid positions, right?
Yeah. So they're elected positions. So the way it works, and again, people misunderstand it too. You're electing a director for a term, typically 3 years. Once those directors are elected every year, those directors then come back outside of that. And between them, they select the executive positions. And often it is president, treasurer, secretary. Those are the typical three executive offices, depending on the size of the condominium makeup. I have seen some boards that are 5 members. You have what's called the director at large. So they're there for the vote participation subcommittees. Some have, you know, they could be up to 10. If you get some larger condo corporations that share resources with a commercial plaza, you know, they share community property. There's others that have shared boards of governors over condominiums. But essentially, the executive officers are selected within the board. You're electing the director and they decide for that year who is going to be the executive officers.
Do they ever bring in an external party that's a subject matter expert? I think you mentioned in the past, engineer and an accountant. Is that a fee-based director or is that...
They have, and that's the discussion where it's going. That's kind of where the discussion's going, right? Because right now is a prudent board, if they need to speak to an engineer, they'll hire a firm. And they'll also, you know, hire a legal counsel, whichever, right? So you will have people in those fields gravitate towards it. So where I live, which actually is a co-tenancy, which is not a freehold, not a condo, we're the Wild West. One of my fellow directors is actually an engineer. So he doesn't give his professional advice, but he gives his view on what he sees, generally speaking, from an engineer standpoint. So there is that intrinsic value in having professionals on your board, right? Succession planning should be happening. So I will not always be on my board. So we need to bring out owners' involvement to have succession planning. And many of these largest condos actually have committees. They'll have common space committees. You know, they'll have, you know, community relations when it comes to dealing with local politicians, things like that. Like, there's always a different avenue, right? And you should be involved. I actually work in that side as well. We'll get involved with local ministers, housing policy, short-term Airbnb and stuff, all that fun stuff. You want to be involved, because if you're not, someone else makes the decisions for you.
The next question I want to ask is something I just want you to touch base briefly on it again, because you answered this before. If you're having an issue with the condominium board itself, is there someone or somewhere that you can complain to? Now, that's different than having an issue with, you know, a tenant or a particular element of the condominium. I'm talking about if you have an issue with the board itself, what do you do?
An issue with the board or a sitting director, there's really two mechanisms. So one, the first one is calling a special meeting. Any owner can call a special meeting for any item that's been voted on, passed that. They have that. That is in the act. So say the condo did pass a bylaw saying no smoking. And so what happens is they push the bylaw out. If there's no feedback, it's typically a 30-day window. If no feedback, the bylaw passes, right? Things like that, the rules and regs, there's different mechanisms for those being created and enforced. But if you have an issue with the board itself or a specific director, you would ask for a special meeting. They can't deny the special meeting. You just got to follow the mechanism for it. So if it's a high rise, they often have a meeting room. It's typically a 30-day window. You call a special meeting for the item in question, whether it be to you're calling for a recall, you're calling for a director discussion, whatever it is, that would be the public mechanism.
Is all it takes is one vested participant to call a special meeting?
I only hesitate because it depends on how they've created the condominium rules and the bylaws, right? So it could be one. It could require more than one to call it together, right? And again, I go back to not as a judgment against this person, but you have in the courts, they have the ability to, you know, identify someone as a vexatious litigant, right? And meaning, you know, and surprisingly in condos, there is people who are just dedicated to submitting complaints all the time. So could you imagine if they passed a rule about, okay, we want garbage to go out, you know, no earlier than 7, not 6. Great. I'm submitting a special meeting about it, right? There's got to be mechanisms in place because complaints are usually driven out of three avenues, in my opinion. They're not educated on the process and why the rule came into place. And that could be partly on the directors for not educating, or the participant for not choosing to be educated, right? There is some self-awareness responsibility there. There's a personal vendetta against the board or the director or an owner, which we see quite often, usually often a past director, or maybe a decision was, you know, passed that, or a ruling made on a request they had that wasn't preferable. Or the third one is, it is a verifiable concern. But if there isn't a check and balance, that verifiable concern gets into the white noise mix of everything else. I only say the caveat that depends on how the rules and regs are broken down. And the great thing about condos is it's all in writing. It's right there in your rules and regs. It's like beautifully. It's like this beautiful little like warm blanket in a cold winter's night.
So that all goes back to the importance of reviewing your rules and regs. Mm-hmm. Tell me, is it possible to get title insurance on a condominium?
It would be limited in its scope, right? Because you're essentially buying a share of building. If you think about it, look at a 50, you know, story high rise as an example, you're buying almost like an embassy. Your exclusive use is a little element, right? So that's your little fife dome, you live in it. So your insurance be restricted to what's controllable by that owner.
Yeah, where I'm kind of coming from is if you were able to get title insurance on a condominium, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, because of some incompetencies of your board, there's a special assessment. I'm wondering whether if there was any way, shape, or form that you could insure yourself against that special assessment. And I suppose from what I'm hearing is that the answer is no.
You can't protect yourself in that context. But if the board has done something that was untoward and it's been happened, where a buddy comes in to quote, does the job, they would lose essentially the veil of corporate protection of the liability gone. The corporation will likely sue them.
Yeah.
Right? Sue them.
Of course.
And or your insurance company would probably get involved going, look, this is, you know, an issue. Your mortgage company would. And you'd probably have a pretty substantial, again, not stepping into my lawyer's, you know, buddy's world there. I would say that it's quickly realized when there's negligence by a condo director pretty quickly because everything's in writing. They think that it's not, like you can't review emails and minutes of meetings. So I would say that it's pretty quickly realized, and I've seen cases where it happens. I will say though that when it comes to special assessments, you get to enjoy communal living, which means you take the risk of communal living.
Good point. Great point. So taking us home, do you have any suggestions for current condominium owners or for those considering adding to their portfolio by purchasing one or several condominium units, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. So the quick answer is if you're a current owner and you're like, you know what, I think I want to get into investing and you live in a high rise, buying your own building. You live there, you got input on it, you can run for the board. What better control mechanism, right? It's like building an ADU or an SDU or a granny flat. It's on your property. But a lot of condo owners are like, you know, I want to invest. And they start looking at different buildings. I'm like, you're in the building. Why not buying your building, right? Now, if you're looking into getting into condo investing, educate yourself on the Condo Act. Check out the resources I talked about, the Condominium Authority of Ontario, again, CCI, the Condominium Institute, 17 chapters across Canada, Eastern Ontario, Golden Horseshoe, Toronto, London. Find out. There's professionals out there that understand and have a passion for condominium living. Talk to your accountant. I'm going to say this again. I love my CPAs. If you're buying investment real estate, do not think that you're going to go to the pop-up accounting services that show up in malls during tax season to do your investment portfolio. You can. I would recommend surround yourself with professionals on a consistent basis. So if you don't have an accountant or you buy investment real estate, get one first. Then speak to a broker. Yes, surprisingly, a real estate broker is pitching the real estate business, but somebody who knows condominiums. And when you get a lawyer, purchase that real estate that they understand condominium law. That would be the short, quick initial start.
Those are great points. And to add more fanfare to what you just said, we've touched on several of those points, primarily about building a team around any type of investment strategy. And here it holds true even more so when you're considering purchasing a condominium unit. Mike, thank you so very much for being our guest. This has been just an incredibly informative podcast. If people have any questions for you or would like to reach out, what's the best way for them to get hold of you?
Well, they can send us an email to, you know, our team. I got a great small boutique team. We're passionate about condos and real estate. So it's info@harafirmare.ca. I'll send it to you. It sounded great when I created it. It's horrible to say it out loud, but it's info@terrafirmare.ca or our phone number, 613-721-7434. Reach any members of our team. We're always available to answer questions.
Fantastic, Mike. Now, you're not off the hook yet.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Mike, I'm going to be asking you to describe to our listeners, and this is right up your alley, what a special assessment is.
So a special assessment is what people often have the biggest fear of in condominiums. And it's something that homeowners have had the entire time that homes have been around. You buy a house and you go, my God, it's a beautiful house. And then 3 years later, you go, huh, why is there a waterfall coming down my wall? It looks like the roof has a hole in it. And you go, hey, you know what? Remember when I said I was going to set aside 10% of my budget every single month to pay for future expenses and I didn't do it? So now I got to go hire a roofer who either A, has financial terms, or I go to my bank and I go, can I have a line of credit, use my credit card, or use some cash and do some payments? That's special assessment, people. You're just not calling it. We call it maintaining your home. Now, in condominium world, you'll have your reserve fund, but oftentimes things can happen outside the scope that are unknown. Maybe the pool had a massive issue, you had to replace it. Maybe one of the elevators failed. Maybe there was a concern with the parking garage because, as anyone knows, in Ottawa, we have a lot of extreme temperature changes in a short period of time. So a special assessment is created when there isn't enough ready funds for that expense. It's reviewed by an engineer. You have your property manager and your board look at it and say, look, we need X number of delta dollars to affect XYZ. And that assessment is allocated over your percentage of ownership. So the larger units, the ones who have two parking spaces, they pay a greater proportionate share. And that's how special assessment is allocated. It's either a one-time fee, a payment plan. There's actually industry partners out there who finance special assessment funds. There's actually financial companies out there that provide financing for regular projects and for special assessments. But it's nothing to be afraid of. It is nothing to be afraid of. The question is, you have to ask yourself, why did a special assessment happen? That's the big question with them.
There you go. Thank you so much. Mike, I can't say enough about what a bona fide expert you are about this topic. I welcome any of our listeners to please reach out to Mike if you have any questions in regards to condominium purchasing or ownership or regulatory issues. He is by far the most learned in that field that I know. Thank you again, Mike, for being part of the show. It's been a pleasure having you.
Well, thank you to both. I appreciate this opportunity. Education to me when it comes to investment, real estate, condominiums, or any topic, people need to be passionate about things that interest them. And part of that passion needs to be education, paramount above all else. I became educated because of a passion. And a little dirty secret, everything I shared today is freely accessible to the public to find out and learn. There's a great opportunity. So thank you for today to both of you. I appreciate it.
Great. Anything to add, Bernie?
I've enjoyed this conversation. I really have. Having managed a 15-story structure, understanding operating expenses, capital expenses, reserve fund, having someone coming and doing an assessment, really appreciate it when you're having the work being done over time as opposed to 1 year. It's like, oh my gosh, here we are. Because I was at the bottom of the building one day doing something and the earthquake came by and the lights went out. And I was really grateful we fixed that pillar when the rebar was coming through. So yes, sometimes you benefit directly and immediately. If you have any questions for Fred, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. In fact, you know, if you're even more curious about other elements of this stuff, Fred has a course. Fred, how can folks find the course?
Well, we're really excited to announce that probably within the next couple of weeks, maybe by the time this podcast airs, the first four courses dealing specifically with investing in real estate will be released. We have spent a considerable amount of time rewriting and reproducing the courses, and they're now just in their finishing throes. So I'm really, really excited to be able to offer those to our listeners. Coming soon, stay tuned. So join us next podcast when we'll be discussing building inspections with Jeremy Taylor and Matthew Fagan of Cambium. Should be a real interesting conversation, and it's actually going to tie in quite nicely with some of the discussion points we had with Mike today. So again, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Thanks. See you next podcast, everyone.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.